June 27, 1995. A warm summer morning in Mason City, Iowa. The sun had barely risen when the alarm clock in Jody Huizentrit's apartment began to ring. But Jody never turned it off. She never showed up for her morning anchor shift at KGMT-TV. What followed was a discovery that shattered the quiet Midwestern town. In the parking lot of her apartment, police found a scene that told a chilling story. A pair of red high heels. A bent car key still dangling from the door. Fresh scratches on the pavement. Signs of a struggle. Jody had vanished. Without a single confirmed witness. Without a single trace of where she went. Over the next three decades, her case would draw national attention, accusations, wild theories, and a relentless search for answers. From mysterious van sightings to sealed warrants and deaths in silence, this is more than a missing person case. It's a haunting journey into manipulation, obsession, and the secrets people carry. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Rise of a Star, Jody's Journey to the Anchor Desk. In the heart of Minnesota's farmland, a bright and determined young woman grew up with dreams that stretched far beyond the gravel roads and cornfields. Jody Sue Huizentrit, born on June 5, 1968, in Long Prairie, was a middle child raised with Midwestern values of hard work, cheerfulness, and grit. Her hometown was quiet, surrounded by fields and framed by community pride. The kind of place where neighbors still waved from front porches and the local diner knew your usual order. From a young age, Jody stood out. Friends described her as driven, sunny, and the type of girl who made everyone feel special. She was athletic, a standout on her high school golf team, and quick to flash her warm smile. But beneath that smile was something sharper, an ambition that pulsed with energy. Jody wanted to be on television, not as an actress, but as a broadcast journalist, a truth-teller with poise under pressure. After graduating from St. Cloud State University in 1990 with a degree in mass communications, Jody wasted no time. She started her broadcasting career in Iowa, small markets, long shifts, learning the ropes. She landed her first serious on-air role in Alexandria, Minnesota, and by 1993, she accepted a job at KIMT-TV in Mason City, Iowa, as the morning anchor. Her co-workers at KIMT saw her as a breath of fresh air. Energetic, always smiling, and genuinely kind. She wasn't just a newsreader. She connected. Whether covering a school fundraiser or interviewing a local hero, Jody brought empathy to the desk, something audiences felt. Ratings for the morning show improved. Jody was going places. Still, life in Mason City wasn't exactly glamorous. Jody lived alone in a modest apartment complex, drove a red Mazda Miata, and had a small, close-knit circle of friends. She loved golf, kept a journal, and was known to stop by community events even after hours, always saying she wanted to understand the people she reported on. In early 1995, she confided to friends that she was hoping for a bigger opportunity, maybe a move to a larger station, perhaps even Minneapolis. She'd made a short demo reel and sent it to a few regional affiliates. Though she loved her viewers, Jody wanted more, responsibility, more visibility, and more respect. That ambition, once again, was lighting the way. But with rising ambition came new pressures. Some of her friends began noticing changes in her tone, moments when she seemed tired, maybe a little wary. She had talked about a male acquaintance who seemed to show up often, sometimes uninvited. She brushed it off, but those close to her later recalled an undercurrent of discomfort. Still, Jody powered forward. She was just 27. Her future looked limitless. A local celebrity in a small town, she handled the spotlight with grace. On June 26, 1995, Jody was the guest of honor at a small get-together hosted by a friend named John Vansis, a much older man in his 40s who some believed had more than friendly feelings for her. That night, he played a homemade video of Jody's recent birthday party. She watched and laughed, unaware that just hours later, her life would come to a sudden, violent stop. At 3:40 a.m., the next morning, her colleague at KIMT called her apartment. Jody had missed her alarm and wasn't at the studio. Half asleep, she answered and promised she'd rush in. That was the last time anyone heard her voice. By 7 a.m., police would be standing outside her Miata, staring down at her abandoned shoes, broken key, and a mystery that would echo through the decades. The bright light that once lit up Iowa's morning news had disappeared, and the search for the truth was just beginning. Chapter 2. The Last Night, Inside Jody's Final Hours. The evening of June 26, 1995, began like so many others in Mason City, slow, quiet, and unremarkable. But for Jody Huizentrout, that Monday night would be the final snapshot of a life abruptly interrupted. While the town around her settled into routine, Jody's last known movements were being carefully recorded. Not by surveillance, but by memory. And those memories would become the centerpiece of a mystery still unresolved 3 decades later. Earlier that day, Jody had anchored the morning news, left the station, and followed her regular schedule. She played a round of golf in the afternoon, a favorite way to unwind. Her competitive streak on the course was well known. She was upbeat that day, as always, and showed no signs of fear or worry. Later that evening, Jody accepted an invitation from John Vancis, a 49-year-old friend and admirer who lived just a short drive from her apartment. John, by his own account, had developed strong feelings for Jody, though their relationship was never confirmed as romantic. To him, she was more than a rising star. She was someone he wanted close, maybe too close. That night, he invited her over to watch a videotape he'd created from her recent 27th birthday party. He said he just wanted to relive the good times with her. Jody agreed. According to John, she arrived at his home around 8 p.m., laughed through the birthday tape, and stayed for about 2 hours before heading home. He told police she left in good spirits, mentioned her early morning shift, and drove off into the night. But that account, while consistent in its retelling, left room for doubt. No one else saw Jody leave. No other witness could verify her exact time of departure. And John Vancis, a man nearly twice her age, would soon find himself at the center of growing suspicion. Jody's final known phone call came just before bed. She called a friend to discuss plans for a water skiing outing the next weekend. She sounded relaxed, cheerful, already thinking ahead. By all indications, she had no sense of danger, no worry clouding her mind. No one knows exactly what time she went to sleep, or if she ever made it into bed. When her colleague at KIMT called the next morning around 4:10 a.m. after she failed to show up, Jody answered, her voice sleepy and apologetic. She said she had overslept, but would be in soon. That phone call was the last confirmed contact. Jody never made it to her car. At some point between hanging up the phone and reaching the parking lot of her apartment complex at Building C of the Key Apartments, something happened. A struggle broke out. Neighbors later reported hearing screams, but no one called the police. One neighbor would later describe hearing a thud or muffled yell around 4:30 a.m. But by the time daylight broke, the only evidence left behind were the contents of Jody's life, spilled onto the pavement like clues in a riddle. Police would find her red high heels, her blow dryer, and her briefcase, all scattered on the ground beside her Mazda Miata. The key was bent in the car door, as if she had been interrupted while unlocking it. A partial palm print was lifted from the vehicle, but it would never lead to an arrest. By the time KIMT staff called again, just before the 6 a.m. broadcast, panic set in. A colleague drove to her apartment and saw the chaotic scene outside. Authorities were notified immediately. Jody's car was still there, untouched. But Jody was gone. And just like that, the clock started ticking. Investigators acted fast, but within those first crucial hours, the trail was already cooling. There were no eyewitnesses to the abduction. No security cameras in the lot. No signs of forced entry into her apartment. It was as if she had vanished into thin air, except for the evidence that screamed otherwise. Theories started swirling. Had someone been watching her for days? Was it a stranger, or someone she knew? Why had she left her apartment in such a rush that she still carried her blow dryer and work supplies? One theory stood out early. Someone had been waiting for her. They knew her schedule. They knew she came down around the same time every morning. They knew she often ran late. And they knew she would be alone. Someone had planned this. And whoever it was, they had just erased a rising star, before the world even realized she was missing. Chapter 3. The Crime Scene. What the Evidence Tells Us. The crime scene outside Apartment C at the Key Apartments was not soaked in blood. It wasn't riddled with bullet casings or broken glass. It was quiet, tidy even, at first glance. But the details left behind on that small patch of pavement would become some of the most heavily examined pieces of physical evidence in one of America's most haunting cold cases. By 7 a.m. on June 27, 1995, the Mason City Police Department had officially launched their missing person investigation. Within minutes of arriving at Jody Huizentrit's apartment complex, officers knew they weren't dealing with someone who had simply run away. The signs of a violent abduction were subtle but chilling. Jody's red Mazda Miata sat in its assigned parking space, just steps away from her apartment door. Her key, still bent and partially inserted in the driver's side lock, was the first ominous detail. It suggested she had been attacked mid-motion, likely while unlocking the door to leave for her early morning anchor shift. Scattered near the car were several personal items: her red high heels, her blow dryer, her makeup case, her briefcase, still zipped but lying on its side. These weren't dropped accidentally. The pattern suggested a struggle. Fast, frantic, and abrupt. The items weren't clustered together. They were flung. Detectives noted drag marks in the dirt nearby. A small section of the grass appeared flattened, as if someone had been pulled across it. There were scrape marks on the pavement, too shallow but consistent with someone resisting. One of the most puzzling finds was a partial palm print lifted from the exterior of Jody's car. It was smudged, difficult to analyze with full certainty, but it became one of the first and only physical forensic clues from the scene. Unfortunately, it would never lead to a confirmed match. No blood. No broken nails. No fingerprints. Whoever took Jody, if they used force, did it cleanly. Inside Jody's apartment, nothing appeared out of place. Her bed was made. Her shoes and clothing were in order. There was no sign of forced entry. Nothing was stolen. Whatever happened to her, happened outside. Neighbors were questioned. Some remembered hearing what they thought were screams between 4:30 and 5 a.m., but no one called the police at the time. One witness recalled seeing a white van parked in the lot days earlier. Suspicious, unfamiliar. But no one saw Jody being taken. No security cameras captured footage. No eyewitness accounts confirmed a vehicle speeding away. Within 48 hours, the FBI was brought in. The case was elevated from a local concern to a national mystery. Forensics teams scoured the parking lot and surrounding area. Soil samples were taken. A search dog was brought in to trace her scent. It stopped abruptly near the edge of the parking lot, consistent with her being forced into a vehicle. The dog couldn't track beyond that point. Meanwhile, authorities began asking harder questions. Who would know Jody's routine? Who had access? Who had motive? They began interviewing co-workers, friends, and anyone Jody had spent time with in the days prior. Some of the focus shifted quickly to John Vansis, the older man who had hosted her the night before. His story was straightforward. She left his house around 10 p.m., but no one else could confirm that timeline. His house was never searched thoroughly. He voluntarily gave a statement, but was never arrested. Over time, rumors began swirling. That Jody felt uneasy in the days leading up to her disappearance. That she had confided in friends about a man who made her uncomfortable. That she thought she might have a stalker. But none of it led to a break. The crime scene told a clear but limited story. Someone waited. Someone knew her schedule. Someone approached her silently, from behind or the side. They acted fast. They dragged her to a car or van. And then they vanished. There were no screams heard by everyone. No tire marks burned into the concrete. Just silence. The kind that speaks louder than words. What began as a crime scene had now become a haunting echo. One that would ring out across the country as one of the most chilling unsolved disappearances in modern journalism. Chapter 4. Vanished in Silence. The first 72 hours. The first 72 hours after a person goes missing are critical. Every investigator knows that time is the enemy. Leads dry up. Witnesses forget. Trails grow cold. In the case of Jody Huizentrit, those 3 days would become a storm of confusion, media frenzy, and desperate action. But they would not bring her home. From the moment officers arrived at the Key Apartments on June 27, 1995, it was clear that something was deeply wrong. Jody, a reliable anchor known for punctuality, had missed her shift without warning. Her car was still parked. Her belongings were scattered. And she was gone. The news spread quickly inside KIMT-TV. Co-workers who had just seen her the day before now faced the unthinkable. A colleague and friend had been abducted. Some were in shock. Others burst into tears. Several volunteered to help search immediately. producers, reporters, anchors, they all joined the effort, not just as journalists, but as human beings trying to find someone they loved. By mid-morning, the police held a press conference. Jody was now officially listed as a missing person under suspicious circumstances. Flyers were printed. Volunteers canvassed the neighborhood. Local businesses placed signs in windows. Schools, churches, and community centers opened their doors to host search groups. People who had never met Jody felt personally invested. She wasn't just a familiar face on TV. She was the face of Mason City. By day two, the FBI was involved. Helicopters flew overhead. Dogs swept the fields and wooded areas surrounding the apartment complex. Divers searched nearby bodies of water. Volunteers fanned out in organized search lines. Dozens of leads poured in. A report of a white van seen nearby. A man walking alone near a wooded trail. Someone who matched her description, in a gas station two towns over. None of them checked out. Investigators interviewed dozens of people. Co-workers. Friends. Neighbors. Former partners. They looked at phone records, examined her apartment again, and traced her last known movements. But despite their efforts, nothing solid emerged. One name, however, kept resurfacing: John Vancis. He was the last person known to have seen Jody. He had hosted her at his home just hours before she disappeared. He admitted to investigators that he had feelings for her, and that she didn't feel the same. He said they were close friends, that she confided in him. But others found his interest unsettling. Vancis maintained his innocence. He allowed police to search his vehicles and gave interviews to the media. In one interview, he emotionally recalled how he had once promised Jody he would never let anything happen to her. That statement would later raise eyebrows, as it struck some as too rehearsed, almost performative. But at the time, no physical evidence tied him to the scene. Still, something felt off. By day three, the media had descended on Mason City. National outlets sent crews. Satellite trucks lined the street near KGMT. Jody's story was now on every major network, not just because she was a journalist, but because of the chilling details of her disappearance. The public responded with urgency. Local businesses raised reward money. A hotline was set up. More volunteers joined the search. Candlelight vigils began, and Jody's picture was suddenly everywhere. Taped to light poles, printed in newspapers, broadcast across the country. But the leads stalled. No ransom call. No note. No new evidence. And Jody's phone, credit cards, and ID had not been used since the morning she vanished. For her family, her mother Imogene and her two sisters, the weight was unbearable. They drove down from Long Prairie and faced the press with courage. They begged for help. For answers. For something. Anything. Imogene's voice cracked on the evening news. We just want her back. We just want her safe. Her plea struck the nation. But still there was silence. No body. No communication. No sign of life. As the third day passed, a chilling truth began to settle in. Whoever took Jody had planned it carefully. They knew when to strike. They knew how to move without being seen. And they knew how to leave without a trace. This wasn't random. This wasn't sloppy. This was deliberate. Jody Huizentrut had vanished in silence, and despite the town's efforts, the trail was already starting to fade. Chapter 5, Suspects, Stalkers, and Suspicion. Who wanted Jody gone? By the fourth day of the investigation, Mason City was no longer a quiet town. It was the center of a national media storm. Camera crews hovered around police barricades. Investigators fielded dozens of new leads each hour. And behind the headlines, a much quieter process was taking shape. One of elimination, suspicion, and psychological analysis. Who would want to hurt Jody Huizentrut? She had no enemies that anyone could name. No criminal past. No hidden scandals. She was kind, friendly, hardworking, and ambitious. But when a woman disappears, investigators always start with the same question. Who was closest to her? At the top of the list was John Vancis. John was nearly 22 years older than Jody. He was a divorced father, a Mason City resident, and a familiar face in Jody's life. They met through mutual friends, bonded over their shared love for golf and social gatherings. John frequently organized get-togethers that Jody attended. But according to multiple friends, he was deeply infatuated with her, more than Jody was comfortable with. In the months before her disappearance, Jody had confided to some that John was getting too close. She never accused him of being threatening. but she seemed increasingly uneasy with his attention. Still, she remained polite, even visiting his home the night before she disappeared. John told investigators that Jody left his house around 10 p.m. on June 26th, after watching a video from her birthday celebration. No one else could confirm this. He claimed he had nothing to hide and voluntarily spoke with police, even appearing on television to proclaim his innocence. Yet something about his behavior kept raising red flags. Some said he was overly involved. Others said he was too eager to stay in front of the cameras. He often referred to Jody in possessive ways, once saying, "I loved her. I didn't hurt her." But police never charged him. They found no physical evidence linking him to the abduction. Another avenue explored involved the idea of a stalker. Friends recalled moments when Jody expressed concern about being followed. One friend remembered her saying she thought someone had been watching her outside her window. Another said she once received a call from Jody in the middle of the night, unnerved, but unable to explain why. Jody had also reportedly received disturbing letters in the mail, not explicitly threatening, but unsettling enough to make her feel uncomfortable. Investigators attempted to trace the source of these messages, but the leads dried up. No fingerprints, no return addresses. Still, the theory lingered. Someone had been watching her, tracking her schedule, waiting for the perfect moment. The early morning hours, alone in a dimly lit parking lot, were ideal for a planned abduction. And whoever did it knew that. As the weeks passed, the suspect pool grew. Co-workers, former boyfriends, neighbors, a local convicted sex offender who lived just blocks from her apartment. Even an ex-police officer with a history of stalking women was questioned. One name that resurfaced in later years was Christopher Revock. He was known to have lived in Iowa around the time of Jody's disappearance and reportedly made disturbing comments about women in the media. Revock was not officially named a suspect, but his name appears in unsealed records from later investigative documents. In 2017, more than two decades after Jody's disappearance, police filed a sealed GPS warrant for two vehicles belonging to John Vancis, vehicles he didn't even own in 1995. The public didn't learn about the warrant until 2020, and its contents remained mostly hidden. That decision led to an intense legal battle. Why had police gone back to John after all those years? What data did they believe could still be found? And why was it kept secret? In 2025, a court finally ordered partial unsealing of the documents. The details remain limited, but the message was clear. John Vancis was never fully off the radar. Still, no charges. No arrests. No justice. The truth was becoming harder to grasp. Every name brought more questions than answers. Could it have been a stranger? Someone passing through town? Could it have been a man obsessed? Someone who had built a fantasy life around her image? Could it have been someone she trusted? Or was it someone who had stayed quiet all along, in the shadows, untouched by suspicion? One thing was certain. Whoever took Jody knew what they were doing. They moved fast. They left no trail. They silenced the loudest voice in town and vanished like smoke. Chapter 6, The Long Silence, Years of Theories, Dead Ends, and Devotion. The days after Jody Huizentrout's disappearance turned into weeks. The weeks turned into months. And slowly, painfully, the search began to shift. From the urgency of finding her alive, to the quiet, devastating possibility that she might never be found. But her case never truly went cold. The town of Mason City carried her absence like a weight. For years, her red Mazda Miata remained parked in a police garage. Her desk at KIMT was left untouched for weeks before the station finally hired a replacement. Her family continued to drive hundreds of miles from Minnesota, posting flyers, organizing searches, and begging for answers that never came. Theories poured in from across the country. Tips were called in almost weekly. Some were from psychics claiming to see visions. Others came from people who insisted they saw Jody at a gas station, a truck stop, even another state. Each time a lead emerged, it reignited hope, and each time it failed, it cut deeper. One of the more chilling possibilities was that Jody had been taken by a serial predator, someone who had done it before and would do it again. Investigators quietly consulted with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. They analyzed the method of abduction: early morning, low traffic area, precise timing, minimal evidence. It suggested planning, not impulse. But again, no match to any known offenders. Her family worked tirelessly to keep her name in the headlines. her mother, Imogen Huizentrout, became the public face of the case. She gave interviews, lit candles, and cried on camera more times than she could count. She refused to let the world forget her daughter. In 2001, 6 years after Jody vanished, she was legally declared dead. But her family refused to stop searching. The mid-2000s brought a new generation of attention. The rise of internet forums and independent true crime communities gave Jody's case a second life. Amateur detectives combed through records. Bloggers dissected every known detail. The case was featured on shows like 2020, America's Most Wanted, and 48 Hours. In 2010, a former police investigator named Steve Ridge began working the case privately. He followed up on old leads, interviewed former acquaintances, and urged the public to keep talking. He wasn't alone. Groups like FindJody.com, founded by journalists and law enforcement veterans, created a central hub for updates, timelines, and calls for information. But no breakthrough came. In 2015, 20 years after the abduction, the Mason City Police Department confirmed that they still had no suspects in custody. No DNA. No solid witness. No crime scene beyond a few scattered personal items and a bent key. The case remained an open wound. Then came the GPS warrant of 2017. Investigators quietly requested a judge's approval to obtain GPS data from two vehicles registered to John Vancis. The timing raised eyebrows. It had been more than 2 decades since Jody disappeared. Why now? What new information had surfaced? The warrant was sealed, which only fueled public curiosity. For years, its contents remained locked away. But what made it even stranger was that the vehicles in question were not owned by Vancis in 1995, suggesting investigators were either chasing a broader connection or trying to pin down his whereabouts in recent years. The public didn't find out about the warrant until 2020, and when they did, the internet exploded with speculation. Why had Mason City PD waited so long to act? Had Vancis ever truly been cleared? And most importantly, what was in that warrant? In the background, Jody's family was aging. Her mother, Imogen, passed away in 2014, never knowing what happened to her daughter. At her funeral, mourners wept not just for a mother, but for a promise unkept. Jody's sisters carried the burden forward, appearing in documentaries, meeting with detectives, and holding annual vigils. A billboard displaying Jody's face remained lit in Mason City, a constant reminder that someone out there knew the truth. Her friends continued to ask the same haunting question. How does someone disappear in the middle of their life, in the middle of a quiet town, with no one seeing a thing? And how does the person responsible stay invisible for this long? As the 30-year anniversary approached, the silence began to feel like part of the crime itself. Not just an absence of answers, but a reflection of how easily the world moves on from unresolved pain. Yet behind the scenes, the case was never closed. And as whispers began to emerge of sealed documents being reopened, new suspects being questioned, and search teams deploying to rural fields in neighboring states, hope, however fragile, returned once more. Chapter 7. The GPS Warrant: Unsealing Secrets and Revisiting the Prime Suspect. For more than 2 decades, the name John Vancis hovered just outside the reach of formal charges. Always nearby, always mentioned, but never arrested. He had become the shadow that trailed Jody Huizentrout's name in every documentary, every press interview, every anniversary update. And yet, by law, he remained a free man. But in 2017, quietly and without announcement, investigators in Mason City filed a sealed GPS warrant for two vehicles registered to Vancis. At first glance, it seemed like a long overdue development. But when the public learned years later that the vehicles in question didn't even exist in 1995, the story took a darker, more confusing turn. Why would police request GPS data from vehicles that weren't around at the time of the abduction? The most likely explanation was this. They were tracking Vancis's modern-day movements, possibly searching for signs that he had revisited a disposal site, private property, or secluded location that might connect to Jody. Whatever they were looking for, they believed he knew something. Something that had never been spoken aloud. For years, the warrant remained sealed. Not even journalists or Jody's family were allowed to view its contents. Public frustration mounted. Online forums erupted with speculation. Had new evidence come forward? Was this part of a renewed investigation? Or had police been sitting on a critical lead for years? the Mason City Police Department refused to comment. The secrecy only deepened the mystery. Finally, in April 2025, after a prolonged legal battle, portions of the warrant were partially unsealed. The documents revealed that authorities had obtained search histories, cell phone data, and location records tied to the vehicles and to Vancis's personal activity in Minnesota and Iowa. While exact details were redacted, one thing became clear. John Vancis had never been cleared of suspicion. He remained a person of interest, even after all these years. At the same time, new focus began to shift toward the small town of Winsted, Minnesota, roughly 160 miles north of Mason City. In October 2024, unmarked vehicles and K-9 units were spotted in a rural area near Winsted, conducting a targeted search for human remains. Residents reported seeing teams with cadaver dogs walking grid patterns through woods and abandoned farmland. Authorities refused to confirm whether the search was connected to the Huizentrup case. But sources close to the investigation suggested that the area was part of a re-examination of timelines, based in part on the GPS warrant data. The search came up empty. No remains. No clothing. No evidence. Just more questions. But behind the scenes, pressure was mounting. If Vancis knew something, and he was under increasing surveillance, time was running out. Then came a twist no one expected. John Vancis died in December 2024, just weeks after the Winsted search. The cause of death was not publicly disclosed, but reports suggested a rapid medical decline. His death left investigators scrambling. If he had ever intended to speak, he took his secrets to the grave. Some saw it as the end of the case. Others believed it was only the beginning of a new phase, one that no longer needed to tiptoe around his legal rights. For the first time in nearly 30 years, law enforcement was able to fully examine his statements, belongings, and associations without obstruction. Legal teams began pressing to fully unseal the entire GPS warrant, arguing that Vancis's death eliminated the risk of compromising an ongoing investigation or violating privacy. The public wanted transparency. Jody's family wanted closure. And the truth, whatever it was, now felt closer than ever. If Vancis was guilty, he had outlasted justice. If he was innocent, then the real perpetrator was still out there, unseen, unchallenged, and possibly watching. But if anything was certain, it was this. The GPS warrant wasn't just about technology. It was about the last desperate hope to track the truth, in a world that had nearly forgotten where to look. Chapter 8. Other suspects, new leads, and the trail that refuses to die. While the shadow of John Vancis loomed over the case for decades, investigators never put all their hopes in a single theory. Jody Huizentrup's disappearance was too clean, too fast, and too precise to ignore alternative possibilities. Even with Vancis now gone, the hunt for truth continued, stretching into corners long left untouched and names that had once been overlooked. One of the most persistent theories involved the possibility of a stalker, someone Jody didn't know personally, but who had watched her from a distance, built an obsession slowly, quietly. She was, after all, a public figure. Her face appeared on television every weekday morning. She followed a strict schedule. She lived alone. For someone with time and motive, she would have been an easy target. In the months before her disappearance, Jody had told several friends that she felt uneasy. She mentioned someone knocking on her window late at night. She thought she was being followed. She even asked for self-defense tips. These weren't taken seriously at the time. No formal complaint was filed, but in hindsight, they painted a disturbing picture. Was there someone lurking in the shadows, waiting for the perfect time to strike? In the years that followed, new names emerged. One was Tony Jackson, a convicted serial rapist who had operated in Iowa and Minnesota during the 1990s. Jackson was serving a life sentence for multiple violent assaults. He had lived in Mason City, just blocks from Jody's apartment at the time of her disappearance. When police questioned him in the early 2000s, he denied any involvement. Yet an inmate-turned-witness later claimed that Jackson confessed to abducting a woman in Mason City. Investigators attempted to verify the details, but found inconsistencies in the account. Some pieces fit, others didn't. No charges were ever filed. But the theory lingered, that a predator, not a friend or admirer, had taken Jody. Another name appeared in unsealed legal documents in 2025. Christopher Revock. Not much was publicly known about him, but internal records confirmed that Revick had been flagged in the early stages of the investigation for making disturbing and misogynistic statements about female news anchors. He had no clear link to Jody, no confirmed sightings, no direct connection, but some investigators believed he might have stalked her from afar. Like others, Revick was never charged. The truth was, dozens of names crossed police desks over the years. Some were dismissed immediately. Others were pursued for months. And a few, like Revick, Jackson, and Vances, became recurring figures in a mystery that refused to die. Then there were the anonymous letters. In 2003, someone sent a journal to a reporter, a strange, cryptic notebook filled with phrases and imagery that seemed to hint at Jody's case. The handwriting was neat. The tone was personal. Pages referenced her eyes, her silence, and the morning she left. It didn't name Jody, but the implications were clear. Some believed it was a hoax. Others thought it was a confession wrapped in riddles. Handwriting experts were brought in. No match. The writer was never identified. The persistence of FindJody.com, the nonprofit dedicated to solving the case, helped keep the spotlight burning. They posted regular updates, created a podcast series, and even erected a billboard near Jody's apartment that read, "Don't sit in silence. Someone knows something." It wasn't just a plea. It was a challenge to the conscience of a town, to the memory of the past, and perhaps to the person who had taken her. Then came 2023, nearly 3 decades since Jody vanished. A new tip surfaced. A man, reportedly cleaning out the belongings of a deceased relative, claimed to find an old journal with clippings of Jody's disappearance. There were scribbled notes, including one that read, "She wasn't supposed to fight." Police responded immediately. Forensics teams examined the journal, fingerprints, and handwriting. Nothing conclusive, but it reopened an old theory that someone involved had died and that secrets had died with them. Despite all this, no one has been arrested. No body has been found. No final piece has fallen into place. But the trail refuses to disappear. Every few years, a new spark reignites the case. A partial unsealing. A sighting. A confession. A name that doesn't quite go away. And the clock keeps ticking. Chapter 9. The family, the journalists, and the fight to keep her name alive. As the years passed and suspects faded, one thing never changed. The determination of those who refused to let Jody Huizentrup be forgotten. While investigators chased leads and theories, Jody's family, friends, and a growing group of journalists kept her memory alive, turning a tragedy into a national symbol of unfinished justice. Her mother, Imogene Huizentrup, became the anchor of the public search. Though her heart broke daily, she stood in front of cameras with courage, pleading for help and forgiveness. Forgiveness for not knowing how to protect her daughter. She attended every vigil, spoke to every reporter, and thanked every volunteer. But behind the scenes, the weight of it all was overwhelming. In her later years, she suffered from memory loss and declining health. When she passed away in 2014, it was with one wish unfulfilled: to bury her daughter. Jody's two sisters took on the mantle. They never stopped asking questions. They never accepted that silence was an answer. They kept showing up, for interviews, for anniversaries, for the truth. They continued to meet with investigators, attorneys, and private researchers. Every time a lead turned cold, they turned back to the public, hoping someone somewhere would finally say what they knew. One of the most powerful engines behind Jody's story was not law enforcement, but journalism, the very profession she loved. In the early 2000s, a small team of former news reporters launched FindJody.com. Not as a website, but as a mission. Their goal was simple: make sure no one forgot. They compiled a complete timeline of Jody's disappearance, interviewed friends and co-workers, collected tip line submissions, and tracked public interest. They placed billboards in Mason City with haunting messages. Some featured Jody's smiling face. Others simply asked, "Who took Jody?" "Someone knows." They partnered with television shows like 48 Hours, 2020, and Disappeared, amplifying the case on national stages. They worked with podcasters and documentary producers. They created a podcast of their own, revisiting every lead, every suspect, every shred of evidence. And through it all, they never once claimed to have the answers, only the responsibility to keep asking. Even within the walls of KAMT-TV, Jody's legacy remained present. Each year on June 27th, the morning show paused to remember her. New anchors who had never met her still carried her name with reverence. The newsroom kept a framed photo on the wall. Some journalists considered her case the reason they went into reporting in the first place. It was more than a missing person story. It was a lesson in vulnerability, in truth, in the fragility of safety, especially for women in the spotlight. Over time, Jodi became a symbol. For many young journalists, she represented the dangers they could face. For others, she was a reminder that even in quiet places, evil can move unnoticed. But she also became a beacon. Her disappearance helped spark conversations about women's safety, routine vulnerability, and the psychological toll of being watched. In 2020, a group of young filmmakers began working on a documentary about Jodi. They interviewed old friends, visited her hometown in Long Prairie, and walked the same parking lot where she disappeared. As they filmed, they were struck by something unexpected. How many people still cared? Not just those who knew her, but strangers, townspeople, podcast listeners, journalists. They carried Jodi's story like a scar, invisible, but real. They didn't just want answers. They wanted dignity. They wanted to prove that even if a person vanishes, their story doesn't have to. And then there were the quiet ones. The woman who lit a candle outside KDMT every June 27th. The postal worker who handed out flyers long after the news vans left. The teenager who became a cold case detective because of Jodi's story. These were the invisible threads holding her memory together. The fight to keep Jodi's name alive was not about fame. It wasn't about theories. It was about love, a love so strong, it refused to let her become another file in a cabinet marked unsolved. For almost 30 years, that love never faded. And even if justice never came, the world never stopped listening. Chapter 10, 30 years later. What remains, what matters, and what might still be found. It has now been nearly 30 years since Jodi Huizentrup vanished from a Mason City parking lot in the early morning hours of June 27, 1995. An entire generation has grown up without knowing her name. But to those who remember, her disappearance remains as vivid as the day it happened. There is still no confirmed suspect. There is still no body. There is still no arrest. But something else remains, something stronger than silence, the will to keep searching. Every year, on the anniversary of her disappearance, people still gather. Candles are lit. Names are read. Some come to remember her smile. Others come in hope. A few come in guilt. No one leaves untouched. Even as time pushes the case further into the past, new technology, new generations of detectives, and a new sense of urgency continue to move the case forward. Digital forensics are better than ever. Unsolved cases are being reopened all over the country with breakthroughs in DNA genealogy and behavioral mapping. Jodi's case, too, remains open. Authorities in Mason City have confirmed that they are still actively working leads. The GPS warrant, the sealed files, the tips sent to findjodi.com, these are not relics of a cold case. They are live documents in an active investigation. In 2025, renewed pressure mounted to fully unseal all legal documents related to the GPS warrant. With John Vance's deceased, many believe there's no longer any reason to withhold information. If the public could see the full picture, they argue, maybe the missing puzzle piece would finally fall into place. But beyond law enforcement, Jodi's story now belongs to something bigger, a legacy. She represents the cases that don't make front page news, the women who vanish without explanation. The towns that are forced to mourn without graves. The families left to chase ghosts. And still, her name brings people together. In schools, journalism classes teach her story as a case study in vulnerability and ethics. In communities, her face reminds people to speak up when something feels off. In homes, her family still sets an empty chair every June. What remains is this: Jodi mattered. She wasn't just a news anchor. She wasn't just a victim. She was a daughter, a sister, a friend, and a symbol of how one person's story can echo far beyond the moment they vanish. And what might still be found? That's the question her family asks every day. Maybe it's a piece of clothing buried under decades of dirt. Maybe it's a long-forgotten letter in a dusty box. Maybe it's a guilty conscience that's been silent for 30 years, finally ready to speak. Justice does not always come quickly. Sometimes it comes late. And sometimes, it comes because the right person hears the right words at the right time. So the billboard still stands. The podcast still publishes. The candles still burn. because someone somewhere knows what happened that morning. And until that person speaks, the search for Jody Huizentrup will never end.